Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Wednesday's edition of Kildare Focus, and my thanks to the show's producer, Ciara Noble, for sitting in the hot seat yesterday. Coming up on this afternoon's programme, we will be talking about the latest report by the Ombudsman for Children, which says that 2020 was a devastating year for kids in this country. 1,100 households have been served with eviction notices over the last 10 months, despite the fact a ban on evictions was in effect. I'll be joined by Aoife Moore, political correspondent at the Irish Examiner, on that. Two separate reports, one by the ESRI and the other by the National Teens Food Survey, show increasing levels of overweight and obesity in children in two separate age groups. I'll be talking about that with Kildare GP Dr. Brendan O'Shea. And vaccination of prisoners in Portlaoise and Wheatfield prisons begin this week. Molly Joyce will join me on that. She's Legal and Public Affairs Manager at the Irish Penal Reform Trust. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email, studio@kfmradio.com, or tweet us at KFM Radio.
Best of the 80s, 90s and noughties.
There is an increase in the number of children contacting the Office of the Ombudsman directly last year. Just shy of 1,200 complaints were made. I'm joined now on the line by Nuala Ward. She's Director of Investigations at the Office of the Children's Ombudsman. Nuala, you're very welcome to the programme.
Well, thank you. Delighted to be on.
That's a huge number of complaints, and particularly notable because they were direct contacts by children.
That's right. We had a double amount of children contact us this year compared to last year, which was actually very good. And they felt that they wanted to have their voices heard and to feel empowered, especially with all the changes that were happening last year due to COVID that was directly impacting on their lives. So when they contacted us, it was very much in relation to how they were struggling with remote learning.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these children, some of them did have laptops, they did have reliable Wi-Fi, but others didn't, or else they were sharing a laptop with lots of brothers and sisters. So what they were talking about, how they were struggling and how difficult it was to learn and to do their schoolwork in such conditions.
No, go ahead.
Okay, sorry, it was just that they were so powerful in terms of what they were telling us about. As you can imagine, if you remember last year, all the confusion about the leaving certificate and the junior certificate, and that caused them huge distress. And every one of them that contacted us about that, they all talked about the mental health impact the lack of clarity was having on them. And they also then, of course, calculated grades came along, another new thing to grapple with, and so they were again contacting us just to try to understand how it might affect their lives. And finally, we had a particular group of children who were living in, they themselves weren't very high risk to COVID, but a member of their family were, so it could be a parent or a sibling, and they were very worried about bringing COVID back into their lives if they had to attend school. So what was really helpful is that we took all of their stories, all of their information, and we were able to bring it to different government officials and to the ministers to try and get them to hear to what the children were telling us.
Do you know what? It's really heartening to hear that so many children made those direct contacts and were so forthcoming about their fears, about the reason for their fears, and felt that the office was open to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that I know, even though what they were telling us was very hard and very difficult about what was happening to them, it was actually a real positive thing that they wanted to get their voices heard, that they reached out to us. And I hope that they felt that they were listened to and that we were able to take everything they said to us and try to effect changes for them. So yes, it is definitely something that we really would love, that that'll keep going into this year and next year, that young people will feel empowered and that their voices do matter.
Now, I know a lot of the complaints that you received were directly from children, but equally many of them were not. Can you take us through the manner and tone of those complaints?
Oh, yes. So, of course, the people who contact us the most on behalf of children tend to be their parents, or occasionally it could be grandparents or siblings. Also, we may get different professionals who actually want to make contact us because they are concerned, they want to make a complaint about a service that a child may have received. So the most complaint about sector we get is about education. Mm. Now, that includes schools and the Department of Education, so it's very, very broad. We also sometimes get complaints in relation to family support and protection, so that could be because TUSLA or could be about the HSC. We also obviously get complaints about health. That's also about waiting lists. It could be about primary care. It also, as you know, mental health services can be very difficult for children to get access to. Mm-hmm. We also get complaints about housing and people trying to figure out either they could be homeless, the quality of their housing, or trying to figure out how do they get out of homelessness. And also we would get complaints about justice. Now that would include, for example, complaints we may get from people who live in direct provision centres who also fall within our remit.
I know that the Ombudsman himself, Dr. Niall Muldoon, has raised concerns about potential abuse of children missed during the course of the pandemic. And I know that in particular, that was a key headline item once the schools were stood down from in-person learning, because teachers here have currently and historically played a key role in picking up on the signs of abuse.
Absolutely. And I think this is what has shone a light on how much schools are more than just about education. They're such important parts of children's lives and as a community. So, yes, my understanding when TUSLA actually did their own analysis that when schools reopened, there was a marked increase in the number of referrals. So it just shows how important teachers are, because teachers can see what's going on. They know their children very well. And a lot of times these teachers are a trusted adult for these children. So children and tell teachers what's going on for them at home.
What's your personal key takeaway from going through the act of compiling this report, Nuala? I know that you are Director of Investigations and would be encountering this information on a daily basis.
I think what was very stark for last year was the disproportionate impact that this COVID had on some parts of society and some more vulnerable children. So, for example, I know that Dr. Muldoon spoke this morning about how parents were talking about their concerns about their children with disabilities regressing, especially because their schools were closed. So I think it's really, really important that as we move ahead and plan ahead, that the government considers whatever actions they can do to mitigate these issues that affected these children so profoundly.
Nuala Ward, Director of Investigations at the Office of the Children's Ombudsman, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, despite the fact that there was a ban on evictions instituted not far beyond the beginning of the pandemic, 1,100 households have been given eviction notices right across the country. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by political correspondent at the Irish Examiner, Aoife Moore. Aoife, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so. Were there any particular loopholes in this ban on evictions that would enable landlords to get around it in order to evict people, or was it a blanket ban?
It was supposed to be a blanket ban. So these 1,100 households who received an eviction notice, you could still receive the notice, but they couldn't action it. So they could tell you that you will be evicted when the ban was lifted in April. There was one minor loophole for landlords, and it was if the home or the property was in serious disrepair where it became unsafe for tenants to be there, or the tenants themselves were damaging the property and you could prove it. That was the only time someone could be evicted during the lockdown. The lifting of that, it became possible to evict people on the 23rd of April when the 5 kilometre limit was lifted. And we now know that 1,100 households have been served with eviction notices, and we will expect to see those evictions start to be actioned now as the lockdown loosens.
And it does kind of lend credence to the running commentary by those involved in housing campaigning, particularly that there would be something of a tsunami of evictions once that ban expired.
Absolutely, and what we have seen is that even though there are almost 4,000 people who are in rent arrears, only 475 have actually sought the government's help over their, they have a COVID-19 rental protection. However, campaigners would argue that this really doesn't go far enough, because to receive this rental protection, you need to be able to prove that COVID-19 particularly is what threatens your livelihood and threatens your ability to pay for your home. But there were plenty of people who were in insecure housing that has nothing to do with COVID-19.
I would also question, Aoife, how well promoted that particular protection was, because I'm even surprised that 475 people sought it.
Absolutely. I don't know. I knew a few people who were put on the PUP, and I don't know anyone who was on this rental supplement. It wasn't overly advertised, and then that paired with the fact that the criteria is quite narrow, and the people who are most likely to be evicted would have been more likely to be evicted before COVID-19 anyway. So the very narrow criteria to apply for these rental helps won't even apply to them, because they were already in the situation before COVID-19 even hit. And obviously job opportunities and everything else have only gotten smaller with COVID-19.
So at the moment, we know of at minimum 3,800 households who are in arrears on their rent. And what we don't know, the unknown figure, is how many landlords will move to try and capitalise on the increase in house prices, which the CSO has just advised us of today, 4.5% over the last year. There's mounting pressure on the housing market, which may mean that for many landlords, accidental or otherwise, or who may own one property or two, it makes sense for them to sell. So we could be looking at even more eviction notices in the coming weeks.
Absolutely. And the figures that we had from the Rental Tenancy Board did show that from last August, the most common explanation given for an eviction was that the landlord intended on selling the property. So I think we're just going to see more and more of that. You know, house prices are only getting higher. People, landlords now sometimes can't be bothered with the hassle of, you know, trying to find new tenants, trying to vet new tenants and everything else that comes along with it. They probably just think, well, I can make a bit of money here out of this property and I'll sell it on. And what we don't have, as more and more rental properties are being sold, we don't have more rental properties coming on to the rental market. They're just becoming less and less. And this is where we're going to see what the housing charities call a tsunami of evictions and a tsunami of homelessness, especially family homelessness. Mm. Because they are most likely to have left private rental property and have nowhere else to go because there's more than one person in that household.
And where are these people to go, Aoife? Because the house building, it's going to take years to get back to where it was, even at the low level, just before the beginning of the pandemic. I don't think there's been a year in successive years where government house building targets have been met. So there's an enormous backlog in terms of just meeting existing supply, much less housing people who are in grave jeopardy of homelessness.
Yeah, and you know, you speak to any housing expert and they'll tell you that Ireland needs to be building tens of thousands of houses just to stand still. You know, that's not including population growth and everything else that will come down the line in the future. So I think what we're going to see, and this is already what places like Inner City Health and Homeless are talking about, we're going to see more and more families in emergency accommodation, in family hubs and in hotels, because we are not building quick enough. I don't think anyone in any government, no matter what party it was, could build quick enough to house all the people that we know. We know that homelessness did go down in the pandemic because of the ban on evictions, but that ban has been lifted now, and it will be families, and we are just going to see more and more families evicted into homelessness, and then we will see, you know, more and more hotels being built, because these hotels will never be empty, because there are always going to be homeless families that are using them.
Another thing that may well contribute to an increase in evictions is rent rises. So we had an effective rent freeze for almost a year. But the Taoiseach this afternoon is saying that legal advice given to the government is that extending a blanket rent freeze would lead to challenges in the courts, which means that people who today, as you and I speak, Aoife, could feel relatively secure in their accommodation, could find a letter on their doorstep in the coming weeks or months saying, look, your rent is going up, you're not in a rent pressure zone, I'm putting it up by X amount, and they just cannot stretch to it.
Yeah, and those people, again, will not be able to avail of the government's COVID-19 rental supports. So even though the government is saying we have these rental supports until January 2022, if that is the case, if it was me or you and we were living in our accommodation and then we get a letter in the door and we don't live in a rent pressure zone and our landlord says, right, I'm putting your rent up by €200 and we can't afford that, we also don't qualify for the COVID rental supports. So where are those people supposed to go? It seems to be, you know, there's always this issue with the government that they have legal advice that they couldn't do a rent freeze, they couldn't do an eviction ban. And, you know, there will be legal experts on the other side who will say, technically, that's not their reading of the law. And they believe it should be put to either, I don't know, a referendum or should be put to the courts to see what happens there. But that is another serious worry that landlords will now, because everyone is strapped for cash through the pandemic, that landlords will see a chance here to put up the rent, and they will, because they might need the money as well.
Aoife Moore, political correspondent at the Irish Examiner, thank you as always for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about reports on childhood obesity and low pay.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Now, two separate reports conducted and released in recent days, one by the National Teens Food Survey and the second, an excerpt of the Growing Up in Ireland study conducted by the ESRI, have shown increases in the number of children classified as overweight or obese in two separate age groups. I'm joined on the line to discuss this by Dr. Brendan O'Shea. He is, of course, a Kildare GP, but he's also an assistant adjuvant professor in primary care and public health at Trinity College Dublin and a specialist in general practice and occupational medicine. Brendan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
I suppose in many ways both of these surveys bear out the continuing trend that virtually every cohort in society is experiencing an increase to a greater or lesser degree in the proportion of its membership that is overweight or obese.
It's a generalised phenomenon, but it's definitely more apparent in communities and areas and households that are more deprived. But it is generalised. And I suppose the figures are a cause of concern, and it's good to be discussing them and to decide what we can actually do to begin to address the issue and to get ahead of it.
And why, Brendan, is it more of an issue in households with a greater proportion of deprivation? Is that in terms of foods accessible in terms of the weekly household budget? Is it in terms of education on cooking and preparing and perhaps steering clear of processed foods insofar as is possible?
You have answered the question. It's all of these things. It costs a little bit more to eat healthily, and a little bit more is a big issue in households that are very stressed financially. Mm. We're a very affluent society, but the money isn't remotely evenly spread around, and there are in Kildare pockets of significant deprivation. So all of those factors, we understand, do feed in. And then there are other factors. If you're in a deprived community, you tend to have less access to exercise facilities. You've got a more unpleasant environment. It's not so nice to go out and go for walks and stuff and things like that. So these are all the things that actually feed in.
And then we also saw from the ESRI today, their particular report was looking at children in a slightly younger age group. The Growing Up in Ireland, I think, looks at children aged 9 and up, whereas the National Teens Food Survey looks at older children aged 13 to 18. But both mirror one another in that there are 25% of children in both age cohorts who are overweight or obese. And as we've noted, Brendan, this is a continuing trend. There's also, quite separately, I think that many of us no longer, because it's so prevalent that most of us are overweight, I think 60% of adults, and I would include myself among them, could stand to lose a kilo or two. We no longer recognise what a healthy but slim body looks like.
We're getting acculturated. So I think, you know, in order to respect listeners out there today, what can we actually do about it? What are we doing that's making any difference? We are doing things better. We've definitely gotten much better at having conversations and discussing it. And that is an absolute necessary first step. Certainly, there's been a lot of messaging through the HSE, Operation Transformation. It's become a lot easier to discuss this in consultation. I hope in a healthcare setting, we're beginning to get a bit better and not guilting people about their weight, that people feel comfortable discussing it. So for anybody who's in a household, look at the other side here. 71% of teenagers were within normal weight range. So know the numbers, okay? It's a core skill, I think, to be able to check your own weight, ideally to check BMI. So know if the people in your house are significantly overweight or not. And if they're not, well, then be pleased about it and be positive about it. So you need to get on the scales. A good weighing technique involves getting on the scales, preferably first thing in the morning, get out of bed, go for a wee, pop up on the scales and look at the number in kilograms. Then check your height, which doesn't change all that much for most of us. Some of us are getting shorter now. But know how to calculate a BMI. And if you're wondering how to do that, go on to the Safe Food website, which gives good detail on how to check BMI, both for adults, and it's a bit more complicated for children, but it's really important. It's a simple skill. So know whether you're overweight or not. We all kind of underestimate the extent to which we're overweight, and people do get a bit of a shock when we're on the scales. But these are the first steps in deciding whether we need to react or not, whether yours is one of the households that's affected or not. And if you find that BMI is above 30, then we'd recommend to have a conversation. Now, there's all sorts of places to have conversations. Get on to Safe Food, look at the resources they've got on their website. There are a lot of parts of the HSE website that are devoted to overweight. Have a chat with the practice nurse, have a chat with the GP. Now, another thing we're doing right is the HSE prioritised overweight as one of their top five strategic objectives during the last 12 months. They are recruiting now, I think, over 50 community dietitians to go in and work in towns like Naas and Newbridge and Athy. So up to now, we haven't really had anywhere to refer people. So this is a plus. Another thing that's been identified is the role of bariatric surgery. Now, let's go back to the deprivation thing. The affluent people who are overweight, they're more likely to have private health insurance, and they can have their bariatric surgery in two or three private facilities in Ireland within about 2 or 3 months. The people who have a medical card or who do not have private health insurance, they're on a waiting list of about 4 to 6 years.
My God.
Now, we do know that the HSE has committed to increasing bariatric surgery capacity, and this is one of the solutions. There are many solutions to what is a complex problem, but building capacity for community-based care and for bariatric surgery. And then the third strand, which makes this an exciting area, it's not a heart sink area, is there are online, there's more pharmacotherapy coming on stream. So this is a challenging issue. It's important not to be demoralised about it.
And that's a really key point, I think, Brendan, because this is as much for people experiencing it and for those assisting them medically or in terms of awareness or education, as much an emotional issue as any other. You've noted disadvantage, perhaps a multi-generational disadvantage, either in financial or educational or socioeconomic terms. But how much we weigh is as much tied up in emotional well-being in the general course of events, not exclusively, as it is anything else. And that the guilting piece that you just touched on is really important.
It is. And I think we're getting better at elucidating that and understanding it. There's the Victorian medicine perspective. It's a personal fault. It's an issue of morality. Well, our tools for studying the genetics, the pharmacology, the hormonal forces at play, how these can be manipulated up the way or down the way, is getting better all the time. And the more we understand about this, the more we understand that this is a complex interaction, typically between genetics. We don't blame anybody for their genes, or we'd all go to the wall. and environment. So it's a complex problem with many drivers, but there are many parts of the solution, and I think we're getting better at elucidating and opening up those. You know, if you go back to, 1300, we were all going to die from bubonic plague. Well, we didn't. Later on, we were all going to die from tuberculosis and syphilis. Well, we didn't die from that either. We thought we'd kill each other with weapons in the 20th century. We survived that as well. There are really exciting things happening in the area of obesity and overweight management. Some of them are the soft skills, the talking therapies, the pharmacotherapies, the surgery. There's the political fix. What kind of society do we want? Do we want everybody to have a basic level of comfort and security and health And we do when we stop and think about it. So these are the things we need to work towards.
Well, Dr. Brendan O'Shea, of course, Newbridge GP and an assistant adjuvant professor at Trinity College Dublin, thank you indeed for joining us. Sandra has gotten in touch on this 0833 97 97 97 saying, England does school lunches. Why can Ireland not do the same? We had a lovely nun who made us homemade soup and homemade brown bread. I know that school lunches are provided in certain DESH schools, and I would imagine that the fact that they're not provided in general is because canteens aren't a factor in the overwhelming majority of school buildings, and it may not be practical to bring in school lunches for an entire, for example, 1,000 pupil second level school. So I'd say it's as much a matter of logistics as anything else, but that's a great idea. Ricardo says, hi Ciara, on the topic of obesity, in modern day Ireland it's because of the high energy, highly processed foods, while the natural wholesome foods are expensive. A big difference in a tomato and tomato ketchup. Thank you indeed for that, Ricardo. Now, SIP2's Big Start campaign has said that the early years, historic low pay in the early years sector is forcing childcare professionals out of it. I'm joined now on the line by SIP2 Head of Strategic Organising and Campaigns, Dara O'Connor. Dara, you're very, very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
Just because of the childcare as a sector, pressure on childcare places, pressure on childcare staff is something that we've covered quite frequently, both on Kildare Focus and on Kildare Today. But give us a bit of context for this specific issue.
Okay, so Publil is a state agency, and they survey all the childcare centres, early years services all over the country. And they ask some really basic questions. How much does it cost to have a space? How much are staff paid? What's the turnover of staff? What are the occupancy levels? And that comes out every year. And really this year again, it confirms what a lot of people know and what we've been talking about, is that there's quite deep problems within the sector at the moment. As I'm sure your listeners know, the cost is really expensive to parents. So in Kildare, it's 195 euros per week is the average cost, and the rates of pay are really low, right? For most people, they're below the living wage. So on average, right across the country, it's 11.91 per hour, which is 39 cents below the living wage. But not everyone, so that's an average. So there's a lot of people who are earning below that. So we really have kind of a twin crisis of really high fees and really low pay. And definitely that's leading to a staffing crisis where workers and, you know, professionally qualified educators, they're looking to find work somewhere else. And a lot of them are going down to Lidl and Aldi, where they get a really big pay increase as soon as they walk through the door.
And that's a key point. These are professionally qualified in the area of childcare. They have worked for those qualifications. Many of them will be very experienced in their field, yet they're earning on average €11.91 per hour. Why then would they stay?
Well, I suppose that's the problem, is that they're not looking to stay. That I think a lot of people go into it because they really want to work with children, that they have a passion for their work. And that's what you want, right? That's the type of people that we should be encouraging to come in and to stay in the sector. But what happens is that, because it's 98% women who are working in it, and I think a lot of people can hit a stage in their life where if you want to move out to get a place for yourself or with your partner, if you want to start thinking about having kids, you simply can't do that financially with the rates of pay that are there. And so my colleagues would have lots of conversations with people saying, look, I just can't afford to stay in the sector. This is my passion. This is my vocation. I've studied. I've got my qualifications. But we want to buy a house. And there's just no way you can do it given the rates of pay. So people are voting with their feet, and they're leaving the sector, unfortunately.
And I would imagine, Dara, anybody that's listening to you and I have this conversation that is paying that average per child fee of around €800 for a child here in County Kildare is sitting there doing the maths going, But how is it possible that I am paying this much per month and the person that's tending to my child is earning on average €11.91 per hour? And if you are the person in the middle there, which is the childcare centre owner or operator, you're sitting that down saying, I have massive overheads, I have public liability insurance, I am mandated to have particular ratios of staff to children.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the providing childcare, providing good quality early years is expensive. And everyone's feeling the squeeze. This is the current situation isn't suiting anybody at all.
Mm.
And really, we need, there's two things we need. We do need government to increase investment. We're so far behind our European partners when it comes to state investment into childcare. And it shows. That's made up. That gap is made up with high fees and low pay. So we certainly need to see in the upcoming budget significant moves to be able to increase investment. But we also need a new model, a new system to make sure that the money that goes in delivers. And so that parents can see a reduction in their fees, the amount of money that they have to pay out, that needs to go down. And workers need to see the change in their pocket as well to try and encourage them to stay and to work at their profession and to deliver the quality that they can. So they're the two things that we need, and that's what we are calling on government to do in the upcoming budget, is to bring in a new deal for early years, a new deal for childcare that works for parents and for workers, and to make sure they put the money in to back that up.
Because if the status quo is maintained, Dara, what I would imagine will happen is we've already seen somewhere in the order of a dozen creches and childcare facilities here in County Kildare close over the last year and a bit or so. That trend is likely to continue, coupled with the exodus of people working in the childcare sector from that sector, means that the remaining places, the prices will likely go up because there's such incredible demand for it. And then you have a vicious circle, because the wages won't go up in that context for staff members and they will continue to leave.
Yeah, it really is kind of a perfect storm that you're describing, and that is happening. And it's been an incredibly stressful year for people. Obviously, the people had to return to work looking after the children of essential workers. The nurses and the firemen, and they were doing that without social distancing, because you can't socially distance from a three-year-old.
Yeah.
It's just not the type of work. And this is in the height of the pandemic. And people have just found the whole experience incredibly stressful. People are burnt out, and people need some hope. People need to see that change is possible, because if it doesn't, I think we're going to see more of what you described, more of the exodus of staff out of the sector, and providers kind of making some really tough choices about where they see a future for themselves.
Well, SIPTU Head of Strategic Organising and Campaigns, Dara O'Connor, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the beginning of COVID-19 vaccination programmes at two prisons.
K-Drive Classic Gold with Ben Atkinson. Monday to Friday, 3 p.m. Kildare's KFM.
Every weekday afternoon from 3, we bring you 1 hour of the biggest tunes from the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s. We also take a nostalgic look back at what happened on this day in music. We take your requests and dedications and keep an eye on what's happening around County Kildare. Join me for K-Drive Gold, weekday afternoons from 3.
With Fitzpatrick's Hyundai, Kildare, Naas and Tullamore.
To date, despite the fact that the COVID-19 vaccination programme began at the very, very, very tail end of 2020, only an effective handful of prisoners in prisons right across Ireland have been vaccinated. That is to change in the coming days. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Molly Joyce. She's Legal and Public Affairs Manager at the Irish Penal Reform Trust. Molly, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
It does seem that the rollout of vaccines in prisons across Ireland has been very slow and hasn't really taken place in tandem with specific age cohorts as they have been worked through in the vaccination programme in the general population.
Yes, absolutely. That's our view of it. And while we very much welcome the news today that there is now going to be rollout of the vaccine across the prison population, and that a whole of prison approach is being taken, in that people in prison and prison staff are going to be vaccinated at the same time. Our view is that this is coming very late in the day. IPRT has, from the very start of the vaccine rollout, been advocating for the prioritisation of prisoners as a group living in a congregated setting, and that they should have been vaccinated at the outset in line with other residential settings. Now, that, as you say, clearly didn't happen. And the alternative, of course, is that at a minimum, and at a very minimum, people in prison should have been vaccinated in line with the community. And again, that does not appear to have happened. And so we know that by the end of May of this year, only 2.1% of the prison population had actually been vaccinated, and that compared to 50% of the eligible adult population having received their first dose by the end of May, of the adult population in the community having received their first dose. So that is very disappointing.
Do we have any sense as to why that is? Because it would seem to me, and again, I'm not an epidemiologist, I don't work in the HSCE, I didn't design the vaccination programme, nor the various cohorts and the order of their vaccination, but it would seem that this particular stance would only make sense if prisons were completely sealed off from the rest of the community, if there was no one in, no one out, because since the beginning of the pandemic, people have been entering and leaving prisons, going about their daily working day. So therein risk is created.
Yes, absolutely. And that is one of the key points that we have been making over the past few months, is this link between the community and the prison, and the fact that until people in prison are protected and everyone working within the prison is protected, there is always going to be the risk that an outbreak within the prison could spill over into the community. And indeed, there have been some reports from the UK. I believe their scientific advisory group had some reports noting this in the past few months. And so, as you say, the approach that has been taken doesn't make a huge amount of sense. We know that certain groups such as homeless people and certain members of the travelling community have been identified as groups at higher risk of COVID and therefore prioritised for vaccination, and absolutely rightly so, we say. But the fact that people in prison then haven't been is very confusing, and particularly because we know that there's a higher rate of people experiencing homelessness within prisons, and indeed that there's higher rates of people with severe health needs within the prison population. And so it has been quite confusing. And I mean, all we can really say is what we know is that at the outset of the pandemic, prisons did appear to be being treated alongside similar to residential settings or congregated settings. But that sometime at the end of 2020 or early 2021, this appears to have changed, and they stopped being treated as congregated settings in all of the kind of official output about the vaccine rollout. And we don't know why that is, to be quite frank. But it is, as I say, very disappointing. It also doesn't comply with kind of international duties of the state to provide an equivalent level of healthcare to those in prison. So again, as I say, it's disappointing.
Now, what is happening in the coming days, and by the coming days I mean this week, is that vaccinations will begin to take place at two separate prisons. And I understand, Molly, that the prisons will be vaccinated as an entire entity. So Prison X will be vaccinated all in one go, not necessarily all simultaneously. Then they move on to Prison Y, Prison A, Prison B, Prison C.
Yes, that's my understanding. And our understanding is that that should be completed over the next 4 weeks. And that is the approach that is taken. And as I say, that is an approach that we have been advocating for as early as January of this year to the Minister for Justice directly about the benefits of taking that approach, as it kind of makes sense logistically, but also ethically, it's the most sensible approach to take.
And the first two prisons in which the vaccinations will take place are Portlaoise and Tweedfield. Do we have any information, Molly, as to why these two have been selected first?
We don't have any specific information as to why certain prisons have been selected and the order in which that's been decided, unfortunately. I guess one observation I'd make is that there is a higher level. I should leave it there. I don't actually know why that decision has been made.
What is the total prisoner population in Ireland at present, Molly?
At present, it is approximately 3,800. And what we know is that 15% of that population is aged over 50. And the significance of that is that the World Health Organization has actually recognized that when deciding the kind of elderly band for vaccination, we shouldn't be looking at over 70s for people in prison. We should be looking at over 50s. And that's because of the chronic health needs of people in prison, the recognized chronic health needs, but also what the World Health Organization has described as the aging effect of prisons. So we know that there is actually quite a significant portion of the prison population who fall within a category that are considered in particular need of the vaccine, and that, you know, therefore it's great that the vaccine is now being rolled out over the next 4 weeks, but again, it can't really come soon enough, especially for those people aged over 50 and those with underlying health conditions, of course.
Well, Molly Joyce, Legal and Public Affairs Manager at the Irish Penal Reform Trust, thank you indeed for joining us. My thanks to you all for your company this afternoon. Thanks as ever to Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble and Owen Beattie, who has assisted me on today's programme as well. Do remember that up after the news at 3 is Ben with K-Drive Gold, followed then by Paul with K-Drive between 4 and 7 to take you home. American Country is on at 7 o'clock tonight, followed by K-Country with Liam Kett. And you can always hear repeats of Kildare Today and indeed Kildare Focus from 10 o'clock tonight. Clem Ryan will be back in this seat with Thursday's edition of Kildare Today at 9 a.m.